The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, should we be siding with Israel just because Israel's talked about a lot in the Bible? No, my friend, we should not side with Israel because of the Bible. We should side with Israel for human rights reasons. There are a lot of prophecies about Israel in the Bible that will get fulfilled someday. But I'm going to get back to the human rights reasons, which takes us right from where we left off last week. I began a series about Israel. If you didn't hear part one, it doesn't matter. You can jump in easily. And on my website, you can hear part one. It is posted. We did this in the form of a true-false test, and I'm going to just pick up right where we left off last week. True or false? The Palestinians are a culture dating back to ancient times. They are indigenous to the Holy Land, and this land was conquered and taken away from them by Jewish immigrants from Europe in the 20th century. Answer, false. Well, many Jews did migrate back to this land in the 20th century. There are other Jews whose families have been there for several millennia. The Jewish people have inhabited the land called Israel since ancient times. The people who today call themselves Palestinians have not. I'm going to review the history of the Hebrews from their Egyptian exodus and arrival in the Promised Land, all the way up to their pacified life under the Romans. And then after that and in future shows, I will continue the history of the Holy Land leading up to our own 21st century. But before jumping into an important chronology, we must first acknowledge the intensity of the problem. And that problem, my friends, is historical revision. It is with grave concern that I reintroduce a narrative that was once so obvious. Revisiting the correct sequence events should not be necessary, but we are living in a time when the dire predictions of George Orwell have been fulfilled. This brilliant author of the futuristic novel 1984 predicted a time when history would be rewritten for sinister purposes. While many revisionist histories are floating around today, few are more outrageous than the new version of Israel's origins. In fact, the well has been so poisoned, many of our educated elite have been taken in. Back in 2010, well-known White House journalist Helen Thomas created a news buzz as a result of an interview with Rabbi David Nesenhoff. Nesenhoff asked if she had any comments about Israel. Thomas answered his question with zeal. She said, "Tell them to get the hell out of Palestine." She continued by explaining that the Palestinians as a people are occupied, and it's their land. Her advice to the Israelis was blunt and to the point, go home. By home, she meant countries such as America, Poland, Germany, other European nations, and everywhere else, to quote her own words. Well, the statement did not go over well. Responding to a public outcry in the United States, Thomas finally released a written statement. Don't you love when people release these written statements and try to walk back what they said? She said, "I deeply regret my comments I made last week regarding the Israelis and the Palestinians." Thomas insisted that the comments did not truly reflect her heartfelt belief that peace will come to the Middle East only when all parties recognize the need for mutual respect and tolerance. Doesn't that bring a tear to your eye? Heartfelt belief. That is sometimes difficult to assess. The closest objective barometer would be a person's words or actions. In a later interview with magazine writer David Hockman, Thomas said something which suggested that the public heard her true sentiments quite clearly the first time. She said, "Well, there's no understanding of the Palestinians at all. I mean, they're living there, and these people want to come and take their homes and land and water and kill their children and kill them." Really? The Israelis want to do all that, huh? She went on to say, "The Israelis are not even Semites. They're Europeans, and they've come from somewhere else. But even if they were Semites, they would still have no right to usurp other people's land. There are some Israelis with a conscience and a big heart, but unfortunately, they are very few." All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, it is common for people to have varying opinions about 20th to 21st century Middle East conflict. The notion of Jews not having any historical claim to the land at all is growing in popularity, even to the point where, as you can see, a prestigious White House reporter passes it on. These days, visitors who travel to the Holy Land and visit Bethlehem or other cities in the West Bank are often treated to Palestinian tour guides who explain that Jesus was not a Jew, but rather a Palestinian. Now, while in the minds of informed, devout Christians, the ethnic status of Jesus is less important than his saviorhood, this newly informed identity is still problematic from a strict historical point of view. By denying the Jewish nationality of Jesus, Palestinians are setting up a link to the narrative that Jews are relatively new to the Holy Land. Thankfully, a good, firm cousin of history is archaeology, or history in 3D, as I like to call it. It is sad, albeit interesting and informative, that many modern Jewish tour guides, in response to their Palestinian counterparts, are now going out of the way to point out a truth that was once left unquestioned: ancient connections between Jews and their Middle East homeland. I experienced such a tour back in 2008 during my first visit to Israel, starting with the Western Wall, the Muslim Dome of the Rock, constructed between 687 to 691 after Muslims had taken over the Holy Land, now stands where the Jewish temple used to be. But several walls of the second Jewish temple, built originally under the supervision of Ezra after Jews returned to Jerusalem from their Babylonian exile and fantastically expanded by King Herod a handful of years before the birth of Christ, are still standing in Jerusalem. Herod, a puppet king under the Roman conquerors of Judea, both married a Jewish princess and received from his Roman supervisors the title King of the Jews. Get that? They're not going to call somebody King of the Jews if there weren't a lot of Jews there, folks. A good deal of this magnificent structure is now underground, but on a fascinating tunnel tour, I was privileged to witness the bottom of the wall. Back on top, the walls were enhanced over the years, first by Christians, later by Muslims. Each occupier used a different kind of building block. Herod's design was distinct from the others, and I viewed the exact same type of stone design on a different day at the Masada Fortress, where ancient Jews held off a Roman army for quite some time, before the Romans finally breached their Alamo-type sanctuary. I also walked around an ancient synagogue with Hebrew writing on the floor. It's amazing how the indigenous Palestinians managed to create a culture that mimicked Hebrew history in every way when supposedly the Hebrews did not arrive until the 20th century. I'm sure you get my point. Authentic history is not exactly hiding. It is readily available for anyone who cares to ask or look. While we're on the subject of Israel's beginnings, let us acknowledge that most of her ancient past is recorded in the Bible. I realize the complication this may immediately create for some people. You may not personally believe in God, any kind of God at all. You may consider yourself to be an atheist or agnostic, or perhaps you do accept the idea of a supreme being, but have not, as of yet, encountered any evidence that this deity is to be associated with the God of Scripture. You may even adhere to an alternative religion with its own claims about sacred texts. I respect wherever you happen to be in life. As mentioned before, while I have talked a lot about the accuracy of both the Old and New Testaments, I will not get into much of that subject at this juncture. At the moment, all you need to understand is that most current and classic historians, while perhaps expressing skepticism about the miracles reported in Scripture, nevertheless accept the Bible's general history of the Jewish people. In addition, there are other ancient historians outside of the Bible in some cases, contemporaries of the biblical writers or people who lived shortly afterwards, who corroborate Israel as a Jewish homeland and or go through the history of Israel from the beginning. Some of those writers include Josephus, Philo, the Roman writer Tacitus. Even more important to our current discussion, because we are studying a dispute about the Holy Land between Muslims and Jews, I must point out that even if you do not accept the Bible as the Word of God, the Quran, interestingly enough, does accept the Bible as the Word of God. While the Quran gets a lot of controversial press today due to back and forth arguments about how to interpret its warlike commands, there are many other interesting subjects in the Quran, subjects which should be of paramount interest not only to Muslims, but Christians, Orthodox Jews, and curious people of any background. Many who have not studied the Quran would be surprised to learn that the Quran does not claim to be an alternative to the Bible, but rather a sequel to the Bible. This little-known fact seems lost in a sea of ignorant discussion today. Islam claims that in addition to the Quran, both the Old and New Testament are the Word of God. The Quran talks quite a bit about Old Testament heroes such as Abraham, Moses, and Noah. The Quran also offers a great deal of description about Jesus. While Muslims do not accept Christ's deity, their own holy book does refer to Jesus as one of the prophets. Theological discussions notwithstanding, the point right now is that the Quran itself acknowledges the accuracy of the Bible. And the Bible, once again, is a history of the Jewish people and their ancient homeland. This means the Palestinian Muslims, in order to maintain consistency, would be well advised to accept the Bible's record as trustworthy. And this means even more obviously that Palestinian Christians must accept the Bible's record as trustworthy if they truly wish to honor the beliefs and teachings of their stated Savior Jesus. If you'll permit me to make the obvious obvious, Jesus was born as a Jew in Bethlehem of Judea, according to Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. The word Judea is derived from the word Judah, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, and later used as a title for the expanded southern area of ancient Israel after her civil war. When Jesus began his ministry, he stated quite clearly that the Old Testament, or Tanakh, was an accurate collection of writings. These books not only contained law and prophecy, but history. In first century Judea, the entire collection was referred to as the Law and the Prophets. Jesus himself used that exact phrase. Jesus also celebrated Jewish feasts such as the Passover, commemorating the exodus of the Hebrews from Egypt and journeying to the Promised Land, and the Feast of Dedication, known today as Hanukkah. Hanukkah celebrates another important event of Jewish history, their War of Independence under the Maccabees in the second century. Jesus would not have celebrated these holidays if he did not believe in the events they commemorated.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Back to 1170 AM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. We're talking today about the revised history of the Israelis and Palestinians, and I'm giving you, to be frank, the correct history. Before I continue, I do want to mention that I've just finished a new book called The Holocaust Against Israel. I mentioned this book last week. It is not out yet, but will be out just in a matter of days. So, a matter of days if you're listening to the live broadcast. Many people follow this show off of my website. So if you're listening to a podcast right now, chances are, or listening to a podcast when you listen to it, because right now I am doing it live. If you listen to a delayed podcast, by the time you get this, that book might be out and available on Amazon already. The Holocaust Against Israel, and a lot of the material from this book I'm doing right now. I mentioned that Palestinian tour guides actually tell people that Jesus Christ was a Palestinian and not an Israeli, or not a Jew. And yet that Jesus called himself a Jew. Jesus referred to the Old Testament, believed in the Old Testament, believed in the holidays it commemorates. And so when the Quran, which accepts the fact that Jesus actually lived and was a prophet, and when the Palestinian Christians claim that they're actually followers of Christ, they've got to take his word seriously. With this in mind, let us now back up and start at the beginning. Traveling to the Promised Land after escaping the bondage of Egypt, the Hebrews under Joshua did wage war against the former inhabitants known as the Canaanite nations. These horribly evil countries were actually killing their own babies by offering them on the altar to so-called gods. This was the chief reason why the Hebrews captured Canaan. And their aim was that they were doing so in obedience to God, who wanted to judge the tyrannies. Now, once again, you may not believe that the Israelites truly heard from God. Be that as it may, certain facts about the ancient record are undeniable. First, this command is recorded in the Bible. I'm reading from Deuteronomy chapter 20. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshiping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God. Now, the reason is stated quite clearly, lest they teach you to make any such abominable offerings as they make to their gods, and you thus sin against the Lord your God. It was common in those days to worship gods by placing babies on the altar, killing them, and burning them as an offering. Ironically, the very wars cited by people to accuse the biblical God of a disregard for life were waged against the evil religions and their abominable human destructions that concerned the true loving God. We see this same problem stated in Leviticus, where God commands his people to have nothing to do with evil worship. Leviticus 18, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, for you must not profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Another thing to keep in mind is these Canaanite nations are now completely extinct. That's very important. No, the Jews did not commit genocide and annihilate them, as is commonly charged. At the time of Solomon, many years after Israel took over the land, they were still alive. Nevertheless, the Canaanite nations were certainly displaced, and in the passage of time, characterized by mixed marriages with other nations, there simply were no more Canaanite nations to speak of. This means that even if one wanted to make a case that the fate of the Canaanites was unjust, weak as such a case would be, there are no more Canaanites to return to the land anyway. At first, Israel lived under the rule of various judges. In time, Israelites had their own kings, just as their neighbor nations did. King David ruled Israel approximately 1000 BC. David's existence is corroborated by archaeological evidence. Two pieces of basalt with the phrase House of David in one section and King of Israel in another. And a stele from ancient Egypt also provides much earlier corroboration for Israel's existence as a nation during the time of King Merneptah, the pharaoh who succeeded Ramses II. Remember him? He's otherwise known as Yul Brynner. He was that guy who messed up and saw his men clobbered at the Red Sea, or Sea of Reeds. During the reign of David's grandson Rehoboam, a civil war broke out in Israel, and this one country split into two countries. The nation of Israel in the north and the nation of Judah in the south, named for the tribe of Judah, one of Israel's 12 sons. The tribe of Benjamin united with Judah, which means that the nation of Judah included Benjaminites. It also included the Levites, who being priests had no land of their own as an official inheritance and were allowed to live in both the northern and southern kingdoms. After a repetitious history of apostasy and idol worship, the northern kingdom of Israel was conquered by King Sargon and the Assyrians. The Assyrians had an interesting way of keeping their conquered territories in check. They did it by shuffling the nations. In other words, most of the Israelis were shipped off to other conquered territories, and captives from a multitude of foreign nations were in turn transplanted into conquered Israel. The few Israelites remaining in the land married these new people. This was the origin of the Samaritans, named for Samaria, the former capital city of the northern kingdom. But the remaining Israelites intermarried in far-off lands, losing, with few exceptions, their identity. From this tragic fact of history, we get the phrase lost tribes of Israel. The history was very different with the remaining southern kingdom, the nation of Judah. They, too, were conquered a number of years later by the Babylonians. Unlike the Assyrians, the Babylonians brought virtually the entire people of Judah to Babylon intact. The Jews, a slang term taken from the word Judah, a shortening of that word, lived in Babylon for 70 years. In time, the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians. This means that the Jews, while living in Babylon during the changing of the guard, found themselves under Persian authority. They had, in essence, changed landlords.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Bob Siegel not only writes fiction, but nonfiction as well. Over the years, Bob has received wonderful comments about his book on Christian apologetics entitled, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Many have put this book in the hands of their seeking, unbelieving friends, and the book takes it from there. This is because the book has a rhetorical skeptic that argues with Bob about the harder, less frequently discussed questions. As a result, the reader is immediately aware that they are reading from an author who relates to them. The moment they find themselves questioning something they see, their very question appears in the text. Every question in this book was one that was personally put to Bob during his many years of speaking on college campuses. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
That music always reminds me of the conquering of Judah by the Babylonians and the consequent result that they lived under the Persians. Not really, but that happens to be our bumper music for today. Anyway, the conquering of Judah by Babylon is corroborated by Persian history and Babylonian history. Likewise, Assyrian history records their invasion. So these are nations outside of Israel recording that Israel existed and was conquered by them. In 444 BC, King Artaxerxes of Persia did something unprecedented. He allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem to rebuild their city. An earlier king, Cyrus, had already allowed the rebuilding of the temple. This second exodus into the Promised Land formed the Second Israel, sometimes called the Second Commonwealth. But for most of this time, the Jews lived in subjection to a series of consecutive superpowers. First the Romans, and eventually the Syrians, not to be confused for Assyrians. After a brief period of revolution and independence under the Maccabees, from which the holiday of Hanukkah originates, the Jews were again conquered, this time by General Pompey, who represented that modest, humble little empire called Rome. The Jews were still living under the Romans at the time of Christ, who was crucified in 33 AD by the Roman governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. Now, we have telescoped a great deal of history, close to 2,000 years worth. At no time was there a people in the land called Palestinians. Where did such a name come from? The Romans allowed the Jews considerable freedom. Religious affairs were administrated by a court called the Sanhedrin, made up of two distinctly different parties, the Pharisees, who were rabbis and other scholars, and the Sadducees, priests and those belonging to the Jewish aristocracy. Nevertheless, heavy taxes still had to be paid to Rome, and most Jews absolutely hated the Romans. Certain underground organizations, including the Zealots, worked continuously to make life as miserable for the Roman conquerors as possible. But not all of the rebellion was done as subversive sabotage. Public protests were also waged against governors like Pilate. There were even formal complaints seeking to go over Pilate's head to the emperor. One such appeal achieved its desired effect when Emperor Tiberius instructed Pilate to remove from his Jerusalem palace some shields which bore pagan inscriptions. But the day finally came when the Romans got fed up and decided they'd had enough. Provoking this disintegration of Roman patience was a more formal organized revolt in the year AD 66. A series of battles followed, and bit by bit, the Jews were crushed, even though many of them fought bravely. In 68 AD, General Josephus, who was later to write a history of Israel from Rome, surrendered to General Vespasian. The most devastating defeat of all happened 2 years later when Prince Titus and the Roman Legion defeated the protectors of Jerusalem, laying waste to much of the city and completely destroying the temple. Some of the temple walls, including the famous Western Wall, exist to this day. In 73 AD, Jewish rebels held an Alamo-style last stand at Herod's palaces on top of a rocky plateau overlooking the Dead Sea. This place that I referred to earlier on the program was known as the Fortress or Masada. When the Romans finally breached its fortifications, they found every Jewish soldier dead. They had decided that death was preferable to slavery under the Romans. Many Jews from the other areas of Judea did become slaves. Others were massacred. Still others escaped the slaughter by fleeing the country and spreading themselves all over the known world. And finally, some Jews were able to stay in their homes after the dust settled when the Romans decided they'd done enough damage. A second war against Rome took place in 135 AD under the leadership of Simon Bar Kokhba. His revolution reestablished a Jewish independent state for over 2 years, but a huge Roman army finally destroyed this stronghold as well. After the Romans recaptured Jerusalem, Emperor Hadrian banned Jews from entering it. A handful of Jews remained in the land, however. This included a rabbinic center at Jamnia, just west of Jerusalem on the coast. The famous Council of Jamnia had been held there before Hadrian's time, and rabbis continued to govern their fellow Jews religiously from there, even if they had no more country of their own to speak of. It's very important to remember that despite the high majority of Jews who were killed, banished, or enslaved, a remnant remained in the Holy Land and continued to live there all the way up to the 20th century. One of today's historical revisionist myths teaches that Jews did not come into this land until after the European Holocaust,
displacing Palestine's original inhabitants. But the greatest myth, the myth of the indigenous Palestinians, is about to be exposed and explained. Emperor Hadrian got so tired of Jewish resistance, he did everything he could to both insult them and stifle any remaining ambitions toward rebellion or nationalism. Hadrian accomplished this by renaming the land Syria Palestinia. Palestinia was a Latinized version of the word Philistine. This ancient and notorious enemy of the Jews had long since died off, but the Grecian Roman world became reasonably familiar with Israel's history, and that included knowledge of her old nemesis. Hadrian considered it the ultimate indignity to rename this province of Judea, not with just any name, but a despised name that he could rub the Jews' faces in. Prior to 135 AD, the land of Israel was known solely as a Jewish land. It was first called Israel, later Judah, still later Judea, but it had never before been called Palestine. Even after this new nickname, the people living in Palestine were a handful of Jews and new colonies sent from Rome. When did Arabs come into the land? Well, the term Arab literally means tent dweller. During the time of the Roman occupation and five following decades, most Arabs lived in Arabia. I'll bet you're able to figure that one out for yourself. But Arabs were also known to be nomads, and they could be found most anywhere, so undoubtedly there were a few in Judea before and after the land was renamed. Still, Arabs did not think of themselves as Palestinians, and very few lived in the newly dubbed Palestine. That all changed in the 600s when Muhammad began to spread a new religious movement called Islam. Muhammad was eager to see Islam spread. At first, he tried to influence people peacefully. When this did not work, he encouraged his loyal followers to take up the sword in the name of Allah. This was not articulated as a mere opinion or idea. Indeed, Muhammad claimed that Allah himself had commanded this later strategy called jihad. At first, Arabia was conquered and taken over by the Muslims. Afterwards, Islam reached its hand toward Africa, Europe, and the Holy Land under the auspices of Muslim leaders who were teaching that Jerusalem rightly belonged to the Arabs. This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
As I now continue to use the term Palestine only as a reference point, please note, Arabs did not occupy Palestine in any great number until the spreading of Islam, and they did not rule the land of Palestine until the spreading of Islam. Prior to Arab rule, the land belonged first to the Jews, then the Romans, and then to the new Byzantine church, which emerged from the rubble of a fallen Roman Empire. The Arabs had to overthrow the Byzantines when they wanted the land for themselves. Years later, a different brand of the church, now called Catholic, waged a series of wars, the Crusades we call them, to win back not only the Holy Land, but any land the Muslims had taken from Christians. For a time, Jerusalem changed ownership, alternating between Muslim rule and Catholic rule. Eventually, the land was taken over by Turkish Muslims. Jerusalem became part of the Ottoman Empire and remained a part of that empire until the British, with the help of many Arab tribes, defeated the Turks during World War I. Now the Holy Land was part of the British Empire, a land containing both Jewish and Arab populations who had been living there for many centuries. When the British decided to leave the Middle East, some very controversial decisions were made about who would rule the land in their absence. Obviously, it would be turned over to both Arabs and Jews, but in what proportion? Great Britain's decision created a chain reaction that withdrew many maps, forming the Middle East as you and I know it today. Even though the Middle East had become the prize of the British Empire, England had neither the desire nor the ability to run that region of the world forever. For this reason, they began working to create a series of new states in which the Arabs, who had helped them defeat the Ottoman Empire, could administer their own affairs. Although the term Arabia was already a general description for a large part of this area, many of the Middle East countries we know of today did not officially become independent nations until the British occupation and subsequent withdrawal from this turbulent region of the world. While working to create new multiple states, Great Britain, with the cooperation of the League of Nations, an early prototype of the United Nations, decided that they would also offer an opportunity for Jews all over the world to return to this homeland. This invitation was called the Balfour Declaration. Needless to say, grateful Jews responded with terrific enthusiasm. Indeed, many children of Abraham did migrate from Russia, Western Europe, and other corners of the globe where they had lived for some 2,000 years in ghettos at the mercy of pogroms or harsh policies of anti-Semitic governments. A homeland of their own had been a hopeful vision to the Jews for two millennia. The most familiar Jewish toast, common at Passover celebrations, says next year in Jerusalem. But few thought they were reciting much more than a pipe dream. Now they could really, truly return to Jerusalem. Just imagine how this must have felt. The Jews were going to sojourn to a country of their own, and not just any country. The very land of their ancestors, a land where a remnant of Jews had remained since ancient times, living side by side with Muslims and Christians who also had interests in Palestine and who viewed it as their holy land too. What exactly was offered to the Hebrew immigrants by the League of Nations? Everything we would today call Israel, everything we would today call Jordan, and most of what we would today call the occupied territories. When the Jews arrived, many of them purchased land from Arab lords. In time, a terrain that had been little more than a desolate, flea-bitten combination of swamp and desert swiftly turned green with farmland and transplanted trees. The economy also boomed, transforming this area in such an amazing way that the term metamorphosis barely does justice. New jobs were created, resulting in an influx of Arabs from other regions who now saw Palestine as a land of opportunity and employment, made possible by Jewish farmers and businessmen recently arrived from Europe. What was the proportion of Arab and Jew in Palestine prior to the Balfour Declaration? Well, there were more Arabs than Jews in the land, resulting again from Muslim expansion. But the truth is, there was really only a handful of each people group because, again, the swamp-like conditions limited the kind of life one could realistically enjoy in the Holy Land. The famous author Mark Twain wrote as much after his own personal visit. He was surprised how desolate the Holy Land was, how little was going on there, and how few people inhabited the area. I'm reading Mark Twain's words. "A desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but is given over wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse, a desolation. We never saw a human being on the whole route, hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive tree and the cactus, these fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country." Now, all of this changed when the League of Nations invited Jews to resettle their ancient home. Ironically, it was after Jewish business created a surplus of jobs that Arabs flooded into the territory en masse, creating a situation where the Arabs greatly outnumbered the Jews. We continue now with our true-false quiz. True or false, the Arabs who lived in this area were never allowed to have their own separate Palestinian state. Answer, false, but thank you for playing. In paradoxical fashion, the British, after inviting the Jews to return, sold over 75% of Palestine to the Arabs, creating a new country called Transjordan. This is an extremely important and seldom taught fact. Please catch this. Some 75% of what had been offered to the Jews was sold behind their backs to the Arabs instead. Not only were the Arabs offered a separate Palestinian state long ago, but they have been living in one since the early part of the 20th century. It's called Jordan, a country three times the size of what remained for the Jews. The Jews accepted this betrayal only because they had no choice. After all, a sliver of the promise was better than no land at all. But the Arab nations and Arabs living in Palestine didn't want the Jews to have even a sliver. And fresh controversy broke out over what to do with the remaining 25%. How was the term Palestinian used during the modern-day exodus of Jews into the Holy Land? Prior to 1948, the land had not yet been renamed as Israel. Since the Roman nickname Palestine had been around for 2,000 years, people were used to the title, but this was not a designation adopted by the Arabs. As a matter of fact, Jewish settlers referred to themselves as Palestinians. What did the Arabs living in Palestine call themselves? Hold on to your seats for the big surprise. They called themselves Arabs. There was no Palestinian identity in their mind. The idea of a Palestinian nationality for Arabs in the Holy Land didn't raise its head until the 1960s. It was a publicity ploy invented by the notorious thug and terrorist Yasser Arafat, who himself was not even from the Holy Land, but rather Egypt. Now, we're going to discuss Arafat and his strategies later. For now, all that's important to understand is that under British dominion, the Jews were known as Palestinians, and the Arabs in Palestine were known as Arabs. After World War II, we were never the same again globally. The United Nations was created in an attempt to prevent any similar future catastrophes. The aftermath of the Holocaust also generated a worldwide sympathy for Jews, a sympathy that seldom existed before. However, mercy toward Jewish refugees wasn't entirely worldwide. We'll be right back. Buying a home? Selling a home? It goes without saying that you need somebody experienced and skilled, but you also need a realtor you can trust, a man who will look out for your interests as if they were his own. This is Bob Siegel, here to steer you the right direction with just two words, Fred Valduti. Fred works with Realty Executives All Area, a company that has sold thousands of homes locally since 1994. Putting your home up for sale or selling a home can be stressful, filled with decisions you never anticipated. So put your mind at ease and call Fred Falduti. He sold my home for me at top price. Every step along the way, I benefited from his wisdom and a very generous usage of his time. By the way, Fred Falduti received the Executive of the Year Award for 2014. What? You say that was a couple of years ago? Listen, wise guy, do you want to mark the calendar or do you want somebody to sell your home for you? Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfelduty.com.
Bob Siegel's novels may start out looking like typical stories, but in no time at all, they go directions you would never have dreamed about. Just listen to the premise of Bob Siegel's unusual story, Choice of the Lorelei. Martha Flannery, an aggressive missionary, sets out for the Frisian Islands to convert the newly discovered tribe called Reinu. Here she enters into a strong battle of wills with Dr. Connors, a cultural anthropologist who wants to protect the Reinu people from outside influence, especially evangelism. Connors' strange manners and obsession with the Reinu are only the first of several eerie mysteries, including previous visitors to the island who never returned home, and an elderly gentleman claiming to be 4,000 years old. Choice of the Lorelei, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Mercy toward Jewish refugees wasn't entirely worldwide. It came primarily from a rebuilt Europe rising out of Hitler's ashes and from the United States. The Arab nations refused to even consider the idea of a Jewish state in Muslim lands. New Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and Iraq were now part of the United Nations, but they were outnumbered. When the UN put pressure on Great Britain to fulfill its promise to the Jews, a country of their own, discussions broke forth over what to do with that remaining 25% of Palestine, which had not been turned into Jordan. The Arabs insisted that they were entitled to the remainder of the land. The United Nations placated to them without entirely giving in. A vote was taken, and it was decided that the remaining 25% of Palestine would be partitioned, creating both a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews agreed to this proposal and decided to call their new home Israel, a proud title from long ago before their Roman conquerors had renamed the land. The Arabs gave no name to their side of the partition because they rejected the United Nations decision, promising in no uncertain terms that if the land was partitioned, every Arab country would unite, attack, crush, and destroy the new Israel before it even had a chance to take its first breath. Let me stop for a moment to point out some obvious ironies and dispel some important myths. Myth one, Israel came into existence illegally. How can that be if they were granted their country by the United Nations? Now, look, I am no lover of the UN. You know that if you've been listening to this program. I think it's an organization that should be shut down. It was a nice idea, but it no longer works. It's useless at the very least and often arrives at decisions which defy both logical thought and ethical consideration. But to those who love the United Nations, to those who want to call America's war against Iraq after 9/11 illegal because we invaded without UN approval, a disputed but often coined position, you cannot have it both ways. People from the left who object to the war in Iraq also like to talk about Israel's illegal existence. Face it, if the UN is your barometer for world legalities, then Israel came into existence legally. Myth two, the Arabs in Palestine were never offered a state of their own. As a matter of fact, they were offered two states of their own. The first one they accepted, and it has remained a state to this day, Jordan. The second state was the partition of the remaining 25% of the land. This state, the Arabs turned down. Why did they turn down a chance to have half of this area? Because they figured they were entitled to all of the area. And the decision of the United Nations, the same United Nations that Arab countries had joined and promised to abide by, meant nothing to them. Radio talk show host Dennis Prager once had a female journalism college student on his program. She had just written a pro-Palestinian article for the school paper. The young lady was Jewish herself. As I said before, Jews today tend to be their own worst enemies. Anyway, in the course of the interview, Prager mentioned that the Palestinians had been offered a state of their own back in 1947. The undergrad journalist quickly retorted, "That's not true. They have never been offered a state of their own. Prager responded by expressing grief that a college journalism student would sincerely write an article so void of facts. It was a chilling conversation. Think about it. If her own journalism professors, who evidently had never corrected her article, were not teaching about what truly happened in 1947 under the auspices of the United Nations, it displays one of two things. Either an incredible ignorance, which should disqualify them from being college professors, or a dishonest agenda, which should disqualify them from being college professors. This is the kind of historical revision being taught at our universities today. Israel is the horrible aggressor, victimizing the poor, innocent Palestinians. Not that there shouldn't be sympathy for at least some of the Arabs who lived in Palestine prior to the UN partition. They're always individuals who don't care about politics and simply want to live in peace. Although many of the Arabs in Palestine sided with neighbor Arab countries and attacked the Jews with thunderous enthusiasm, others were given no choice. They were essentially told by countries such as Egypt, join with us or get out of our path, because with or without your help, our soldiers are coming to crush Israel and we need to go through your neighborhoods to do so. Abandon your homes for now, but have no fear. It's only temporary. In no time at all, the war will be over and you can return to your homes. Indeed, you can expand your territory because all of the Jews will be gone. Important note, the issue with the Arabs was not Israel's unwillingness to allow a separate Palestinian state. Israel had agreed to the partition. The Arabs had not. The aim of the Arab nations was actually much simpler, the total annihilation of Israel. Men, women, and children. If you don't believe me, examine a few tasty quotations from the time. From Abid Saad, king of Saudi Arabia, 1947. There are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million people to kill all of the Jews? The price is worth it. From the Secretary General of the Arabs League, 1947. This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres. From the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in 1947, I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews, murder them all. And from this same person, Allah has bestowed upon us the rare privilege of finishing what Hitler began. Let the jihad begin. Murder the Jews, murder them all. Make no mistake about it, the complete, unconditional elimination of Israel was the only true intention of the warring Arab nations. The very notion that they wanted a separate state for Palestinian Arabs that would live peacefully side by side with Israel is a downright lie, a spun fairy tale for the masses. Unfortunately, too many well-intentioned people have subscribed to this hogwash. But the war didn't go quite as the Arabs had planned. Against miraculous odds, Israel actually won the war, and the Arabs from Palestine who had joined the armies against Israel now found themselves without a home. We will talk more about this next week on The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.